Alice Tubbs was deep into a faro game, and she knew something wasn't right. She was losing, and Alice Tubbs did not lose. She made her living playing cards, and she smelled a rat. On the first hand, she lost $500. On the second, she lost $1,000. On the third, she studied the box that held the deck of cards. As the dealer slid a card out, similar to the process of modern-day blackjack, there was a little movement in the box. The motion wasn't as natural or fluid as it should have been. She caught him. She whipped out a .38 caliber revolver that she kept on her at all times. She pointed it at the dealer, who was no doubt shocked at the turn of events. Then she said, "If you'd done that cleverly, there wouldn't be any kick. I can admire a clever crook, I'll admit that. But a clumsy one like you? Now before I pull this trigger, you give me back my money." And he did. The gambling hall gave her back all her money. It's springtime, and if one of your springtime goals, like me, is the eternal quest to get in a little bit better shape, that starts with food. Eating healthy, but also being busy, equals Factor Meals. Fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted meals delivered right to your door. There's no prep, no cleanup. Just heat them and eat them, and most are ready in 2 minutes. There are 35 weekly menu options, which includes gourmet options with premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, and more. There are options for all types of meals, day or night. Tailor the delivery schedule to your schedule. And this month celebrates Earth Day, so look for meals with the badge Earth Month Eats to reduce carbon footprints. Head to factormeals.com/LOTOW50 and use code LOTOW50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code LOTOW50 at factormeals.com/LOTOW50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome to the Legends of the Old West podcast. I'm your host, Chris Wimmer, and today we're telling a few more stories about some of the colorful characters of Deadwood. Plus, I'll take you to the town of Deadwood so you can hear from a few people who live and breathe Deadwood history. Alice Tubbs was a classic Old West character, even though she was born in Great Britain. She was a blue-eyed beauty who drank a lot and smoked big cigars. She was a gambler, a madam, and a bootlegger, and one of the many great characters in Deadwood lore. By the time she arrived in Deadwood in 1890, she was already known as Poker Alice, but she acquired the last name Tubbs when she married Warren Tubbs. Warren scratched out a living as a painter, but it was Alice's winnings as a master poker player that supported the 7 children they had together. Alice loved poker, and she was good at it. Rich men, who naturally thought they were better at cards, learned their lessons the hard way as she repeatedly cleaned them out. Then she'd go on shopping sprees in New York City and come back with closets full of new dresses. Later in life, she ran a bordello in Sturgis, South Dakota, called Poker's Palace, that was incredibly popular with soldiers. One night, it was filled to capacity, so she locked the doors to keep out any more customers. Disgruntled soldiers outside threw rocks through the windows and cut the electrical wires so the place would go dark. Alice grabbed a rifle and fired out the windows to make them stop. Unfortunately, she killed a sergeant and wounded a private. When she was hauled into court to face the charges, the judge started grilling her about the layout of her house the brothel. She shut down that line of questioning real quick with this retort. Hell, Judge, you've been in my place so many times, there ain't a window or a door in the whole damn house you don't know about. Besides, it was so dark in that room, nobody saw who did the shooting. Now, charge us with something or let us go. She was charged with simply keeping a house of ill repute. She paid a fine, and that was that, though the judge probably won in the long run, as the brothel was forced to shut down shortly thereafter. Poker Alice was as colorful as they came, and she lived a hard life, there's no doubt. But she had fun too. When she started up a game, her favorite line was, "Praise the Lord and place your bets. I'll take your money with no regrets." In the previous episode, we barely scratched the surface of Seth Bullock, so let's finish up some of the highlights of his incredible life. If you remember, he was raised by a strict military father, so he was all about law and order. He was tall and charismatic and rarely used his gun. According to his grandson, he rarely needed to. Here's the famous quote. "He could outstare a mad cobra or a rogue elephant." With those abilities, you can see why he didn't need to draw on a lawbreaker very often. The murder of Wild Bill Hickok jump-started Bullock's career. Hickok was killed on August 2, 1876, and by the end of the month, Bullock was the de facto sheriff of Deadwood. He wasn't the first man to hold the office, but he was the best. One of the two men who preceded him was Con Stapleton, who was playing poker with Wild Bill at the time Bill was killed. Bullock enlisted some fearless deputies, and they started cleaning up Deadwood. But Bullock was also a realist. He knew that a mining camp like this had to have an entertainment district, so to speak. So he made a deal with Al Swearengen. They drew an imaginary line across Main Street that divided the town into two districts. The lower end would be the seedier neighborhoods that would be home to most of the saloons. That area was called the Badlands, and it was basically under the control of Swearengen. The upper end of Main Street would be the more respectable area. Based on his work in Deadwood, Bullock was appointed the sheriff of Lawrence County by Governor Pennington in 1877. In 1884, he was elevated to Deputy U.S. Marshal in charge of all of Western Dakota Territory. It was also in that year that he made a new, lifelong friend. Bullock was out on the range pursuing a horse thief named Crazy Steve when he ran across a party of men who had just captured the very outlaw he was looking for. Bullock started talking to the deputy sheriff who caught Crazy Steve. That man turned out to be an ambitious explorer who was hungry for adventure. He came from a wealthy family in New York City, but he had gone west to see the frontier before it disappeared. That man was Theodore Roosevelt, and Roosevelt and Bullock became fast friends. Back in Deadwood, Starr and Bullock's hardware store was destroyed by the fire of 1894. So, Bullock took the opportunity to build the finest hotel in town in its place. The Bullock Hotel would boast three stories and 64 rooms that were steam heated. It had a bathroom on each floor. That was real luxury when it opened for business in 1896, and you can still stay in the hotel today, though it now boasts bathrooms in every room. Legend has it that Bullock's ghost haunts the hotel, so watch out for that too. 2 years later, Teddy Roosevelt led his Rough Riders to Cuba in the Spanish-American War. He appointed Bullock captain of the Black Hills Rough Riders. Bullock was 51 years old by that time, but his troop never actually made it to the battlefields. They made it as far as the training ground in Louisiana, but that was it. Bullock would have fought if called upon, there's no doubt about that, but he didn't have to. When Roosevelt was elected president in 1901, Bullock and 50 cowboys, including early Western movie star Tom Mix, rode in the inaugural parade. In 1905, Roosevelt appointed his old friend, Marshal of South Dakota. Bullock held the post for 10 years, during which it was still a very dangerous job. The Wild West was not gone yet in the Dakotas. During Bullock's tenure, more than a dozen other marshals were killed in the line of duty, but he survived. For his courage, integrity, and service, Roosevelt renamed Scruton Peak in the Black Hills to Seth Bullock Lookout. Roosevelt said of his friend, "Captain Bullock is a true Westerner, the finest type of frontiersman." Roosevelt died in 1919, and Bullock quickly enlisted the Society of Black Hills Pioneers to erect a monument to his friend on Sheep Mountain near Deadwood. Bullock needed them to hurry. He was dying of cancer, and he knew he didn't have long to live. The workers finished the project in a rush, and it was dedicated in September 1919, 2 months before Bullock passed away. When Bullock died, the town honored another of his requests. He wanted to be buried with a view of Roosevelt's monument. Today, if you follow a long, winding path, 750 feet above Mount Moriah Cemetery, where Wild Bill and Calamity Jane are buried, you'll find the grave of Seth Bullock. It looks out on Sheep Mountain, which was later renamed Mount Roosevelt, something Bullock surely would have liked. If there was a Mount Rushmore of Deadwood, it would have to include the image of Seth Bullock, as well as his longtime business partner, Saul Starr. From almost the moment Saul Starr set foot in Deadwood, he distinguished himself as a businessman and civic leader. Along with their hardware store, Starr and Bullock started the Office of Starr and Bullock, Auctioneers and Commission Merchants. They also started a flour business, the kind of flour that's used for baking. Starr was generous, genial, jovial, social, and always lent a helping hand. It's not hard to see why he was a popular man in town. He became postmaster of Deadwood and served as mayor for 13 years. He was chairman of the first state Republican convention when South Dakota was admitted to the Union in 1889. It was said of him in 1901, "Any brief epitome of Mr. Starr's career gives only a meager idea of his strong personality, which has drawn to him in close friendship more associates than it is the good fortune of many men to enjoy. And since he is still in the prime of his life, whatever good fortune the future has in store for him, social or political, will be a success rejoiced by all." That's pretty high praise. In 1890, he and Bullock founded the town of Belle Fourche. It quickly became the county seat of Butte County. Starr passed away in 1917, 2 years before his friend Bullock, and was buried in St. Louis. A friend of Starr's in Montana put it eloquently. "He left us for his last lone prospector tour, and if the streets up there are paved with gold, Saul will be right at home." And here's one final nugget about Saul Starr. I like this story. In 1905, Starr received a letter from a company in Albany, New York, that said it wanted to do business with him. The Albany Perforated Wrapping Company wanted to send him a 1-year supply of toilet paper so that everyone in Deadwood would use its product. And Starr's cost for these 12,000 sheets of toilet paper was just $1. The company would even pay all the transportation and delivery fees. That's how badly it wanted to be in business with Saul Starr in Deadwood. If we're going to fill the third spot on the Mount Rushmore of Deadwood, a good candidate would surely be W.E. Adams. Dime novels and TV shows never talk about William Emery Adams. He wasn't a gunfighter, he wasn't an outlaw, he wasn't a lawman, and he didn't die in a hail of bullets. But if you know anything about Deadwood, or if you've ever been there, you know the town would not be what it is without him. The Adams Museum is named after him. His home, the Adams House, is a museum in and of itself. Two of the interviews on this episode were recorded there. His influence was enormous, and his life was so full that I'll never be able to do it justice here. He was born in Michigan and grew up in Minnesota before moving to Deadwood with his brother James in 1877. Together, they opened the Banner Grocery. They had the same philosophy as Saul Starr and Al Swearengen, though they went about it more like Starr than Swearengen. Instead of making their fortunes by freezing in a creek or digging in a hole to find gold, they would mine the miners. Their business was vital to the community and profitable. Unfortunately, like many others, it was destroyed in the Great Fire of 1879. But the Adams brothers were undeterred. They built their next store out of brick to protect it from fire. James moved to California in 1889, but William stayed in Deadwood and kept expanding his business. He served 6 terms as mayor. He helped build the Mount Roosevelt Memorial. He helped lay the first brick streets in Deadwood. He was on the boards of banks, civic organizations, and the Chamber of Commerce. In 1901, he got out of the retail business and began a wholesale grocery operation that supplied goods to the entire Black Hills region. But his life was not entirely full of grand achievements. He experienced immense tragedy as well. His wife and 2 daughters both passed away before he did, leaving him alone in his later years. But he found a new lease on life when he began a whirlwind romance with a much younger woman. It was his second wife, Mary, who encouraged him to build a museum in Deadwood, one that still stands today. While there are 100 crazy or fun stories about early Deadwood, I want to wrap up with this little gem. It's one of the more absurd gunfights you'll ever hear about. Johnny Varnes was one of the head honchos in the criminal underworld of Deadwood. There are reports that he and his partner Tim Brady tried to hire men to kill Wild Bill Hickok in the summer of 1876. One of the men they supposedly tried to hire was Charlie Storms. Charlie wisely said thanks, but no thanks. Then 2 weeks after Hickok was killed, Charlie Storms and Johnny Varnes got into a shooting match of their own. And of course, it started over a card game. Charlie and Johnny had a disagreement, so they took it outside. They had a shootout in the middle of Gold Street. Guns blazed and windows shattered. 10 shots were fired in all, and not a single one of them hit either man. They were completely unharmed. Johnny and Charlie threw up their hands and called it quits. The only casualty was Joe Ludwig, who took a stray bullet in the hip as he stood inside the Wertheimer & Company store. It was a memorable fight, but one that no one really wanted to remember. Thanks for listening to some more stories about Deadwood history. And now stick around for some stories about the town's history and the Deadwood TV show from some locals who visited the production. All right, everyone, welcome to a very special interview with Daryl Nelson, Exhibits Director of Deadwood History. He runs all the exhibits at the Adams Museum. If you have ever been to the Adams Museum, you will know that it is the centerpiece of history in Deadwood. I was just there recently. There's some fantastic exhibits. I can't wait to go back and do a thorough exploration of the whole thing. So, Daryl, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for agreeing to do this.
Thank you. Thank you. This is a pleasure.
So we before we turn on the microphones, we decided that we were going to do a little compare and contrast between the quintessential good guy of W.E. Adams in Deadwood history and the quintessential bad guy in Al Swearengen. So let's start with the general compare and contrast. Can we do a quick summary? The listeners have probably already heard various parts about their their various history. So what's the quick compare and contrast between these two gentlemen?
Swearengen was ran saloons and dance halls on Main Street in early Deadwood. Known for violence himself, and his gym theater was the site of ongoing fights and conflicts. He was a shyster, a con man, a mean guy, and he did everything he was supposed to do as a bad guy. Adams, on the other hand, same town, same time, came as a prospector. He very quickly saw what was going to make money. He was a successful businessman. He spent his life being a businessman and a civic leader. He was a good guy. He was generous. He was the opposite of Swearengen. Same town, same time, different parts of the city. But history has not treated them the same. And I'm intrigued by why we have done that.
Exactly. That was one of the things we discussed before we turned on the microphones was, why does history remember Al Swearingen so much or so prominently and has almost forgotten W.E. Adams?
I'm wondering if that's a commentary on us and what it is that we like in a story. In some ways, Swearingen is entertaining, but he's quite predictable.
Right.
And Adams, he's not entertaining, but he did surprising things. He did good things. He was proactive. He was visionary. In some ways, very contemporary man. So I'm not sure it's about the qualities of the men specifically. I think it's what we have come to prefer in our contemporary media as, you know, this qualifies as a good story.
And obviously one of the big things that I certainly have become fascinated in was the TV show of Deadwood. So as we're talking about these different things, we can see that's a huge example as to what people have been interested in, that obviously Al Swearingen was a very prominent figure in that show. Mm-hmm. And I'll admit that I loved every time he was on the screen. It was fun and interesting.
Yeah.
And W.E. Adams is not there at all. No presence in the show whatsoever.
What that show can't do because of the nature of a show is that the other part of town was full of good people starting libraries, starting churches, raising
grocery
children,
stores like Adams did.
Businesses. And they both were fully aware of each other's presence. But for the most part, good people don't make good stories. I'm not sure what that's about.
Yeah, but at the same time, when we talked, when I visited the museum and saw all the different exhibits there, we talked about some of the things that the TV show got right. There were several things. For instance, I said in the episode, in the introductory episode about Deadwood, that one of the big things that the TV show got right was the feel of the town, the claustrophobic nature of it, the narrowness of Main Street, the narrowness of the Gulch, everybody living on top of each other.
And it was a filthy place.
Yeah.
And in fact, the profanity was famous, not the same words, but the same level of profanity. The Deadwood streets were famously muddy. One of the first officials that the city council appointed was a health inspector.
Right.
And some of the first laws were about, you can't leave dead animals here. You can't let this effluent go out on the main street. So it was a mixed bag. You know, Deadwood was famous, is somewhat justified to be famous for these things. But at the same time, another part of town was thriving and they had permanence in mind. The prospectors came, they didn't come to build a town. They came, you know, the quintessential private enterprise venture, come make money and leave.
Right.
That was their goal. And other people came to start businesses and stay. So part of what I find about Deadwood, this dynamic, is that they were both going on, and there's several visions for what being here was about, and several kinds of commitments to the community. It's a fascinating mix.
As we've been here walking around, it's really fascinating to stand in the middle of Main Street.
Right.
This morning, as we're recording this, as people are going to hear it, it's not the day that they're listening to it, but we went down early morning and stood in the middle of Main Street, and you could see just how narrow the street is. You could see where all the different businesses that have become famous in Deadwood are within about 150 feet of each other.
Right.
You can just bounce from one to the other.
Right. And if you're standing downtown, you could look from one ridge to the other. And Deadwood's not it's a narrow strip.
Yes.
In a gulch. So there's reason.
Yeah, you can see it. Typically, or a lot of times in the show, you would hear this a phrase rim to rim across the gulch. You can really stand in the middle of Main Street, and if you stand in the middle of Gold Street, you can look straight across the gulch from one rim to the other, and you see just how narrow it is. And you can imagine just how muddy and filthy it would have been to have been there working in the Main Street. And it really is, it almost really is a lower end. There's the Main Street slopes upward toward the quote-unquote respectable area of town, so lower Main Street.
And that's the part that's called the Badlands, and there are reasons for it. Another point that I wanted to go back to was that another aspect that the HBO series got right was the way prostitutes were treated. They were an abused bunch of women, and Swearingen was right in the middle of that. I think it was 1893, the date, I'm not sure the exact date, but in the newspapers, he brings 11 girls, teenagers from Chicago. That's typical of his technique. And so the law had to come in, and remarkably, not all the women wanted to get away from the situation.
Really?
But that is typical of him. Throughout the 1880s and 1890s, he as a person does not make news as much as the ongoing fights and brawls and drunkenness and considerable petty, sometimes not petty violence, that happened around his theater. So that was his. At the same time, Adams is the other end of town, making money, making money, making money, trying this, trying that, expanding. Two different worlds.
Yeah, two completely. Yeah, he's. I know in my research I read that he would, that Al Swearengen would place ads in newspapers for dance hall girls or housekeepers or anything other than what he intended for them to do once he got them to Deadwood. And so he not only just physically brought and recruited women from places like Chicago, which they actually talk about in this series of Deadwood.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
he would place ads and then lure women to town with this promise.
And it is the rare woman who said, "Hell no, I'm not doing this." A famous case of a woman, Inez Sexton.
Okay.
She had been a singer with pretty high aspiration for herself, and she got here and said, "I'm not doing this." And the citizens helped her to find other work and to get out of town.
Really.
Yeah, so it's a good story. But the HBO series really nailed that because the prostitutes, which were given all kinds of kind of whimsical names by the newspaper, resulted in a number of many suicides, anonymous grave sites up in our version of Boot Hill.
Right.
It was that a tough sense. Life for
them.
Yeah,
no, I can only imagine. Can only imagine what it would have been like.
There was one situation in which W. Adams actually confronts Swearengen about a debt.
Really?
And so the two met. And W. Adams, you know, he was this proper guy. He did not back down. So there was some kind of, I forget what the loan was for, but Swearengen used all of the furniture in the Gem Theater as collateral.
Really?
And Adams gets tired of waiting. $2,300.
Okay.
Quite a bit of money then.
Yeah.
So Adams confronts him and says, "Al," or whatever he would say, "I need the money now." And Swearengen said no. So he comes back again and says, "All right, give me $1,000 and we'll call it good." Swearengen says no, $500. And Adams says, no, I want it all. This is it. So he gets the sheriff, and they bring wagons, and they take all Swearengen's furniture.
They actually confiscated it all.
He kind of wins, but by the end of the day, Swearengen had filled it up again, and he was ready for the show that night.
So he didn't actually have to pay off the debt in money. The furniture
he
replaced the furniture.
No, he was reputed to close down or brought into court, and it didn't deter him. So he was focused. It'd be nice to pass judgment on him and say, well, he was all this. He had his reasons, and there was probably at least twice in his life when he was compassionate and considerate. Who knows? But he was tenacious. He did one thing well. And it's I don't know his background. He was family of eight kids. I don't know how he was raised or what his expectations for values were. But he was doing what he knew how to do. Unfortunately, a lot of people got hurt and abused along the way. And in Adam's case, a lot of good things happened. In fact, he's a better example of a man who's bigger than life. Because when he died in 1934, he gave his wife $40,000 in securities, the house, the mansion, and his cars. She invested well in Disney and an IBM.
Right.
Made a boatload of money, and we are still getting money to this day from the foundation that she established. So in the biggest sense of the word, they are bigger than life because the effect of their values is still being felt today.
Perfect. That's a great note to end on. Yeah, we've seen a lot of those contributions as we've been around town.
Right.
That's right. I had forgotten that part of my research, but I'm very glad you brought that up. We'll wrap it up on that note.
Okay.
That's a great way. They really are larger than life characters.
They had
a profound impact on Deadwood, certainly the Deadwood area, and it's still happening. It's still continuing to this day.
It's ongoing. Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much, though. Appreciate
your time.
Thank
you. So welcome.
I'm here with Ty Sanford, the assistant director of Deadwood Alive. We're going to get into a little more detail about the trial of Jack McCall and some other fun stories related to Deadwood, but we're going to start with this element that I found particularly curious when I was doing my research about a potential conspiracy in Deadwood after Hickok arrived, with some of the criminal underworld wanted to assassinate him, essentially. They tried to hire people to kill Hickok. And the two names that rise to the top when we're always talking about this are Tim Brady and Johnny Varnes. So what more can you tell us about this potential conspiracy where maybe Brady and Varnes or other people in Deadwood tried to hire assassins to kill Hickok?
Well, everybody knew about Wild Bill. He'd been made very famous in the old dime novels, made a name for himself as a lawman. And there was more money to be had at the time for people if there was no official law and order in Deadwood. So in order to hopefully try to keep that from happening, they figured the best way was to kill Wild Bill. Of course, they didn't know that Bill had no designs on a job as a lawman there.
Right, they thought he was maybe there to be a marshal at some point.
Because of his history.
Right.
He just wanted to mine and make some money for his new bride. So it was all kind of a sad, wasted effort on their part.
Were you able to find any other evidence of any of this kind of conspiracy? Any other reports about any of these activities?
Well, when McCall fled the camp, he went over into Wyoming territory, eventually wound up in Laramie City. And he gave a report to the paper there in Laramie, and he told the reporter about a sum of almost $800 that had gone missing from his person. Where he came up with that money, we're not entirely sure. Given McCall's kind of seedy element, he could have either stolen it or he could have been assassination money.
Right.
Again, we're not entirely sure, because when is McCall telling the truth and when is he lying?
Right, you know, of course.
He goes on, McCall says that Bill took him for all he was worth and is like, well, you know, fine, whatever. And he slapped him across the face, and apparently Hickok took it kindly. Well, no. Given how we know what Bill is like, there's no way McCall would have slapped him and got away with it.
No.
So he tells that just a sentence after, almost talking about losing a sum of $800. And yeah, when's he telling the truth? We right. never quite know.
Right. So let's jump into the kind of trial itself of Jack McCall. So what was the most compelling part of the trial to you? You've done a ton of research about this. You performed the trial of Jack McCall for people who come to the town of Deadwood. What's been the most interesting part to you?
I still find it interesting that they actually found him not guilty. Despite all the evidence that was brought forth and the defense not trying to say he didn't do it, but that they used somewhat of an affirmative defense that he only did it because Bill had killed a brother of his. Being in a mining camp, it's somewhat of an acceptable defense for a vengeance killing. Jury nullification was very much a thing then and is now. And the jury must have figured that he, given the fact that Bill killed his brother, whether that was true or not, which we found out later it wasn't, they figured that he was not guilty. My own kind of personal theory on that is we're not too far removed from the Civil War. You have General Sherman, his march to the sea, destroyed so much of the South.
Right.
These boys went home to nothing. There was nothing around for them. So what do you try to do? You go from boomtown to boomtown trying to make back a little bit of what you lost. And I figure those boys came to Deadwood Camp trying to make back what they lost. Everybody knew that Bill was a Yankee. He fought for the North. He was a staunch abolitionist. And some of them might have tried to weasel their way onto that jury. They knew that McCall was from the South. You know, Bill's a Yankee. He shot a brother of McCall's. Maybe he's not guilty.
Sure, okay.
I don't have a lot to point to say that is, but that's been my kind of personal theory about what might have happened.
And so probably the most obvious thing that we have to talk about is actually why McCall killed Hickok. It seems to be almost taken for granted that it was the perceived slight that happened in the poker game previously, that Hickok and the guys at the table on August 1st cleaned out McCall because he was a terrible poker player, and Hickok gave him a little bit of money afterwards to go eat and kind of cool off and then maybe come back and play later once he'd regrouped. And so that's the only thing we really have to go on that maybe says why McCall would have killed him. So let's just ask the question flat out. Why do you think Jack McCall actually killed Wild Bill Hickok?
I would say for the reasons you just said. McCall, being a relatively young kid, he was in his mid-20s, and being cleaned out by someone of Hickok's nature, what Bill was trying to do was a kindness, and McCall saw it as an offense. Bill, through his years, he was old and wise. Even at 39,
yeah.
He was old and wise. And he was just trying to take care of the kid. He knew he was out way far away from home, and he just wanted to help him out. And McCall was too hot-headed or bull-headed to see it as a gift and a kindness instead of taking it as an offense. And near on as I can figure, that's the closest I can come to for an emotive.
And have there been other theories posited over the years? Has anyone speculated on something other than that? I mean, obviously we've already discussed the potential assassination element of being paid by the criminal underworld in Deadwood, but is there anything else anyone's come up with?
There were a couple of articles that people wrote in the papers saying, well, yeah, I remember this incident happening. You know, Bill was down there and he was in Abilene, he was the marshal, and well, he went into this baker's office or baker's store, and he goes up to the counter and he asks for a couple of rolls. So the baker provides it and then asks for payment. Well, Bill didn't take any payment out, so he grabs the baker's head, pulls it down on the counter, puts his pistol and shoots him, kills him.
Wow.
And he goes up to the next store. It's a saloon. Well, Jack McCall's brother happened to be the one running that saloon. So he does the same thing, gets a couple of shots of whiskey, refuses to pay. McCall's brother starts to get in his face about it, so he just grabs his brother, shoots him, and kills him. And now McCall, being distant enough that he hears a couple of gunshots, but he doesn't know exactly what's going on, grabs his pistol and comes out, and according to the story, he confronts Bill on Main Street with his pistol drawn, and he tells him to get out of town. And Hickok complies.
Wow.
And decides to leave. Well, now, what we know about Bill, that's not going to happen.
Right.
Bill, certainly at that time, would not have left without a fight. Somebody comes out and brandishing a pistol, no way. But people wanted to, I think of him as the underdog. This is the era we have the Robin Hoods coming out, like Sam Bass, the Robin Hood of Texas, or Jesse James, where these little guys who are,
right.
They're fighting against a big bad government.
Right.
And people see them as heroes, fighting against the government in the form of Bill Hickok.
Okay. And so even if they, obviously, like you said, if Jack McCall comes out in the street and calls out Wild Bill Hickok, if that had actually happened, that story would have ended much differently. We wouldn't even have the events in Deadwood years later. But also the idea that Hickok would have just point blank murdered two people to lead up to that event is so absurd that
yes.
That part's not even believable before you even get to the part about McCall calling out Hickok. That's just such an aggressive and extreme move.
Yeah.
Not only for a guy who, like Hickok, wasn't that type of person, but he was also a lawman. The idea that as a marshal, he would have just murdered two people
without cause.
For getting bread and whiskey is pretty extreme too.
Yeah.
So that story obviously is a little bit aggressive, a little bit on the extreme side of things.
Yeah, about as ordinary as he ever got was when he was with Bill Cody doing the Scouts of the Plains, and they would give him pistols full of blanks, and he'd walk up to the extras as they were dead on the ground, fire next to their pants, and start their pants on fire. Which is a little bit ornery.
Yeah.
That's about as aggressive, I think, as he got.
Yeah, yeah, but I think
Bill was always a prankster.
Well, and that's certainly funny, but also much, much further away from just straight-up execution murders.
Yeah.
Because you didn't want to pay for two rolls of bread.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty aggressive. All right, great. Thanks a lot, Ty. We appreciate your time today. We've gone through a couple different elements of the Jack McCall trial. We really appreciate your knowledge and your time. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
I'm here with two of the owners of the Saloon Number 10 here in Deadwood, South Dakota. We want to talk about their experience on the set of the TV show Deadwood. My three interviewees this morning have all been on the set. You guys all got to participate. You all got to see what it was like, which makes all the rest of us who just watched the show very jealous. So why don't you all introduce yourselves and then tell us about your experiences.
I'm Lori Keene.
I'm Louis Lalonde.
I'm James Olson.
Now, Louis, why don't you jump in and tell us how this all came about. You guys were able to go to set after, I guess, some of the actors came here to visit South Dakota, visit Deadwood, for like a site visit or something like that. Tell me about how all that came around.
We made some very, very genuine friendships with a handful of them. When they came up for it was somewhat of a premiere, come to Deadwood and meet the actors, and
okay.
We hosted a wine dinner in
okay.
this here at the Number 10.
Okay.
And along with that, you know, the whole city and anybody involved really got to know them a lot better.
Okay.
Lori and I and Jim, you know, pushed a little bit more and we deepened those friendships by, you know, making a point of going out there.
So you guys had met the actor whom many people will certainly recognize as Dan Doherty, W. Earl Brown,
yep.
when he came here to Deadwood with most of the cast. Is
yes.
that how that friendship developed?
Yep.
They all came out here to see the town, maybe do a little promotional type thing, and you guys became friends with him. And so when you were in Los Angeles, you got a hold of him to see if maybe you could go visit the set.
It was cold, surprisingly cold. And I was wearing my Saloon Number 10 letter jacket.
Okay.
Which is, you know, maybe one of the few letters I've earned. And I'm standing there, and there's a bunch of people standing around. I said, what's going on? He says, well, they're filming in the building. So they had a little tent set up, and I Marty and I walked over there, and they had like a television, only it was a tunnel to the real television, so they could see the filming. So I stuck my head in, and I'm watching it. As I'm sitting there, somebody comes up beside me and says, "What are you doing?" I look over and I said, "Looks like I'm getting in your way." And he laughed and says, "I'm David Mills. Who are you?" And I can introduce myself. And we talked for a little bit. And he says, "Do you want to be in this show?" I said, "Sure." And that's how we got invited the next day.
Ah, okay. So you just went for just a regular visit on one day and then...
Yes.
With Earl Brown.
Yeah, with Earl. And then your interaction with David Milch got you guys an entree to come back.
Yeah. Milch is another good guy.
Yeah, he was.
He actually came to Deadwood and did a lot of research before even filming the show. And
did he?
I think he was here for 2 or 3 weeks, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
I've never actually dealt to him, but I know some of the our blackjack dealers downstairs dealt to him and met him and did got a real feel for what the town was all about. And,
oh, fantastic. I'd never heard that story. I assumed he had done a ton of research. I'd heard various stories about all the different reading he had done and everything. You can tell by the dialogue and some of the little details that he obviously did a lot of research, but I didn't know he actually came here and spent some significant time here before the show got started. It makes sense.
Yeah.
I can understand. So then you had your first day, your visit, so tell me about the second day. Tell me about going back and potentially preparing to be extras on the show.
We had to be there early.
We had to be there at 7 in the morning for makeup.
And it was like...
It was fun. I liked
it. It was like an hour. You didn't have to wear makeup, Jim.
Yeah,
I did. Oh. Yeah, exactly.
So we didn't get to wear makeup.
Yeah, so. No. So Lori and I were prepared. We
you
were
told
in
me not to shave.
We were ready to, you know, when you
being beautiful,
glamorous. Yeah.
Right. So tell me about the two parts that you guys were potentially going to play in the show. Let's start with you guys.
I'm not going to say what I want to say.
We were elected to be. To be whores.
Whores, yeah.
Yeah, we were whores, and we wanted to be really pretty whores, and we went into costuming. That was our first part. And the first thing they said is that we couldn't wear our bras. Do you remember that?
Yep, exactly.
And that we had to take all of our makeup off.
Yep.
Those girls don't wear any makeup.
Really?
No, yeah. And they wanted to cut our fingernails. They wanted to color our hair even.
They put extensions in our hair. The hair people weren't happy that we were there, because there weren't supposed to be any women on set that day.
Okay.
We were just kind of a fluke.
Right. Right.
Oh.
And yeah. I think, as Lori, I think as we talked about previously, you guys, were you assigned to the Bella Union or the Gem?
I think we were at the Bella Union.
The Bella, I say, yeah, based on the picture we've seen of you guys in your full costume, it looked like you were probably part of the Bella Union crew over there.
At least we were ritzy.
Yeah, exactly.
We were across.
I don't think that costume looked very ritzy, though.
We were across the street.
Yeah,
so
Jim, tell me about your experience there.
We were supposed to cross, and the shooting takes place. The Earp brothers are loading their wagon.
Okay.
We walk across the mouth of the alley as the Pinkerton guy comes in. He says something, and Morgan shoots him.
Yeah.
And we must have walked across there a dozen times. And each time was never quite right. The director finally yells at us and says, "You just heard a shot. What do you do?" And I said, "Well, in real life, I hit the ground so I don't get my ass shot off."
So you actually are on camera. You got to be there. Did you guys actually make it into the episode?
We did.
They did. But what Lori and I...
Lori and Louie, you guys...
They cut for lunch, and then we politely...
We quit.
Yeah, we politely told
we
AP...
We weren't having any fun because we didn't like our hair.
We didn't. We're brats.
So your time as Bella Union employees was very short-lived.
Very
we
brief.
Quit. They said, all right, we're done. We quit.
They did have a small flask
of
vodka.
Who was the producer of the show. We met him during lunch, and we just said, I think we were going to quit. I think we're done. Yeah.
We weren't supposed to be here anyway. There weren't supposed to be women on the set anyway.
Yeah,
so.
Right. This really isn't our cup of tea.
Well, so you guys actually got to be there, and that's obviously one of the big jealousies of many of us fans. We have seen it. We can imagine what it was like. But can you tell us what the set was actually like? The claustrophobic nature of it, the mud everywhere,
It was really pretty magical.
It was
amazing.
I have always thought if you could recreate any day after growing up in Deadwood, any day just for curiosity's sake, what would it be like to have been here in Deadwood in 1876 when the sounds and the smells and the mud and the big oxen rolling into town and the stagecoach And the pianos and
just the energy
just
alone.
The smells. Think of that. I mean, what would it have been like?
Thanks for listening to this bonus episode of Deadwood Stories. Like I've said before, we've got some big things on the horizon, so stay tuned for news about the show. We'll see you soon.